Welcome to the house of the Lord. Today we will try and complete chapter 3. I left you with a piece of homework last week. You may have forgotten, but I haven't. We'll come to that shortly. We closed last week by noting the deep concern that Job's three friends felt for him. Now, they were true friends. That they were true friends can be seen in the fact that their concern was translated into action. Words are said to be cheap, actions not so. It is easy to say, "I'm sorry for you." It's far less easy to do something to help. And we can see in the case of Job's three friends, the sacrifice they had to make to disrupt their family lives, their businesses, their social contacts, and to endure the risk of a long and hazardous journey just to see Job. While they were all in the same, roughly in the same general area, Edom, and the neighboring states, it was still a very long trek in those times, a very long and hazardous trek just to see Job. I draw your attention now to the closing verses of chapter 2, verse 11 through 13. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. As mentioned, a journey like this in those times required very considerable planning and preparation on their part, the more so as the risk was very great, the risk of highway robbers, the risk of wild animals, the risk of running out of water in a semi-desert area, the risks were considerable. So we have no reason to doubt the sincerity of the friends. Verse 12, and when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they could barely recognize Job because he had become so disfigured by disease. When they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they wept. They lifted up their voice and wept, and they rent every one his mantle. They tore the costly outer garment and sprinkled dust upon their head toward heaven. What this means is they scooped up the dust from the ground and threw it upwards and let the dust settle on their head, signifying their complete identity with Job in his sufferings. If Job was among the ashes, so they too were metaphorically among the ashes, as signified by this action of scooping up the dirt and throwing it upward and letting it fall all over their bodies, on their heads and on their bodies. And verse 13, so they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Why the silence? Our modern tendency is, when we visit the house of mourning, for example, we feel inclined to say something to the grieving family or the grieving person. But some commentators believe it was a custom in those days that when you visit someone who is, for whatever reason, in mourning or undergoing severe trial, you show your sympathy by sitting beside him, but not speaking until the grieving party breaks the silence. So the grieving party has to speak first, and then you can say your piece. So we need to bear in mind the difference in customs. The silence of the friends must not be interpreted as indifference. It would be a gross injustice to them. Such was the prominence of Job throughout Edom and the neighboring state from which these three friends came, that news of the reversal of his fortune had spread like wildfire via the equivalent of CNN in those days. But you note something very curious about this whole episode. We are told, or we are given to understand in the first two chapters, that Job had a vast circle of friends. So now his fortunes are reversed, he's stricken by disease. And the question we need to ask ourselves is, what happened to all the other friends? How come only three showed up? And it reminds me of that old adage, laugh and the world laughs with you, weep and you weep alone. And it was so in this case. All those friends just melted away when Job's fortunes vanished, and only these three proved themselves to be true. Those of you who have read further, for example, to chapter 16, verse 1, will realize that at a later stage in this dialogue, Job turned around and called them miserable comforters. And even God himself, in chapter 42, the closing chapter, rebuked these three friends for their words of, so to speak, comfort. So, were they really friends to Job? Enough has been said thus far to convince you that they were at the outset genuinely concerned about Job. But between that stage and what happened as the dialogue with Job went on, something had gone wrong. And that is what is being addressed by this first question. What could have subverted the original plan of the three friends to comfort Job? Because as you will realize very quickly, all that the friends had to say from the initial part onwards served only to hurt Job more and more, and to drive him almost to the point of cursing God. So we need to keep in mind this question. Something went wrong that subverted the noble intention of the three friends to comfort Job. So keep that at the back of your mind. But at this stage, they were true friends. They came alongside Job. And it reminds us of a word from the New Testament, Parakletos, the comforter who comes alongside. So at this stage, at the beginning of the dialogue, they were really comforters to Job in the sense of Parakletos as in John 14 verse 16. Now, this is the homework question that I left with you. I'll divide it up into two parts. How many visitors in total did Job receive? That's the first question. And the related question, how many friends visited Job? So how many visitors did he have in total? Under 10, for sure. But how many visitors? 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What do you think? 4. Toss a coin. 4. I say 5. Total number of visitors. Visitors, mind you. Who was the first visitor that Job had? The very first visitor. Mrs. Job. I'm not talking about comforter now, I'm talking about visitors who came to sit with him or came to talk to him. It was the wife, followed by Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. So now the next question, how many friends bothered to come to visit Job? 3, 4. Well, we will discount the wife. It would be a confusion in terms to call her a friend. So she's one of the visitors, we've dealt with that. How many friends? It's either 3 or 4. So for this, you're welcome to toss a coin and let me know what you think. How many would say 3 and how many would say 4? Just a show of hands would do. Make this exciting a bit. Who votes for 4? Who votes for 3? The key word is friends. And as I have already hinted, there were only 3 friends. What about Elihu? I will try and demonstrate later that he was not a friend. He was a visitor. And we will come to that later. But yes, he was a visitor. The text specifically describes Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar as friends from afar. And if you go back to chapter 2, verse 11, the first part, it is stated so literally. Now when Job's 3 friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came, everyone from his own place, Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, Zophar, the Naamathite. And here, the Hebrew word for friend that is used is rea, which, depending on the context, can signify a degree of intimacy. In other words, in this context, it would be close friend. So the text says explicitly, 3 friends, 3 rea came to visit him. And the same word rea, signifying a degree of closeness with this friend, is used in Job chapter 19, verse 19. Job says, all my inward friends abhorred me, and they whom I loved are turned against me. These inward friends are those who were admitted to Job's inner circle of friendship, the supposedly close friends, of whom finally only 3 proved to be true friends. So what about Elihu now? Elihu, firstly, was a much younger man. And that is significant because in the society of those times, the younger and the older do not associate on terms of intimacy. There is always a very formal gulf between them. Yes, they do interact. I'm not saying they isolate themselves from one another, but they do not laugh and joke with one another as we would today. We are quite relaxed in our church. The older and the younger can share a joke together. But in those days, it would have been unthinkable, even considered rude. So Elihu is described in the text as a much younger man. And he pops up only in chapter 32. Note this, the text does not describe him as a friend. Chapter 2, verse 11a specifically describes Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar as friends of Job. And the specific word used for friends indicates that they were close friends. Elihu is never described in the text as a friend. Moreover, when he begins to speak in chapter 32, granted, there's no way we can tell his body language because there's no way we can go back in time. But from the tone of his remarks, you decide for yourself whether this is the way a friend would speak. I have to jump forward now to chapter 32 and I will read verses 1 through 5. So please follow me closely. This is Elihu starting to speak. So these three men, the three true friends, ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barakel, the Buzite of the kindred of Ram. Against Job was his wrath kindled because he justified himself rather than God. And now pay close attention to 32 verse 3. Also against his, Job's three friends, was his, Elihu's, wrath kindled because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Now Elihu had waited till Job had spoken because they were elder than he. When Elihu saw there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his wrath was kindled. I think it is very clear from the tone of his introductory speech that he was not a friend. He was an interested party, a visitor, but he was not a friend. Why did he come? He had heard of this great disaster, something unheard of, a man of such power and prominence as Job, disfigured, sitting on the garbage or near the garbage dump of outside the city. And I believe he came to see a spectacle, to see for himself how this could have happened, and he was of course not to be disappointed. Back to the three friends of Job, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophite. Those of you who enjoy dipping into genealogies will find, if you care to trace it, that the names of these three friends indicate lines of descent that can be traced back respectively to Esau, to Abraham via his second wife Keturah, and also to Cain via Lamech. The references are in Genesis 36 verse 4, Genesis 25 verse 2, and Genesis chapter 4 verses 21-22. The names of the friends are indicative of lines of descent from Esau, from Abraham, and from Cain. The person who takes the lead, apparently as a spokesman, by prior arrangement is Eliphaz. And in his speech we see that he is a man of ideas, and he starts out well, giving good reasons, good arguments, which are basically supported by the others. The man of ideas is Eliphaz, and he was the spokesman of the three for a very special reason, which we will have to come to later, but I tell you in advance what that reason was. Why the other two agreed that Eliphaz should be the spokesman is because he had a visitation from a spirit that seemed to convey special revelation to him, and that appeared to qualify him in the eyes of the other two, Bildad and Zophar. That qualified Eliphaz to be the spokesman for the group. Bildad supports Eliphaz. He comes up with no new ideas, and he exhibits a tendency to cite tradition as his authority. And as for Zophar, we find that he is the most legalistic and the most dogmatic of the three. And in fact, in chapter 11, you will find that the sharpest, the most painful, the most hurting rebuke of all to Job is delivered by Zophar. He reminds me of the Pharisees of a later period who knew the law so well, but whose faith had become warped by legalism. So he, if you like to think of it in this way, is a Pharisee of the Old Testament, full of the knowledge of the law, but warped by legalism. The three of them, they did set out with all sincerity to comfort Job. They mourned a full 7 days. Why 7 days? We have to go back to tradition. We recall that when Joseph mourned for his father, Jacob, it was a 7 day period of mourning. And when my parents died, I remembered this incident in Genesis 50. And so I specifically had a 7 day period of mourning, first for my father and then for my mother. The principle goes back to Genesis chapter 50 and to Joseph in his actions in relation to the death of his father. Look at it from the point of view of Job. Here come three of his closest friends. What does Job need most of all in that situation? He needs sympathetic understanding. Not necessarily total agreement, but sympathetic understanding. But what is he met with? If you are in distress and you, let's say you call a close friend on the phone and say, I need to talk to you, and you pour out your problems, and at the end of your speech you realize that there is dead silence at the other end, and you keep saying, hello, hello, are you there? Or worse still, if the person comes to visit you and sits and looks at you with such sympathy, when you have finished pouring out your problems, all you see is a face of stone, completely silent. What would your reaction be? It would be an additional factor to drive you into deeper discouragement and despair. And if now, after that period of silence, when the friend or friends who visit you begin to speak, they hit you with a barrage of criticism, all directed at proving to you that there is some secret sin in your life, how would you take it? You know, one of the most crushing blows that we can receive are from our loved ones, whether it be the immediate family, the extended family, or our very close friends. It is sometimes said that no one can hurt us more than a brother or a friend. And it is so in this case also, that the deepest hurt that Job experienced was from the speeches of his three friends. Why? Simply because as his very close friends, they had unique access to his heart. They knew his life inside out. And because of this access to his innermost feelings and thoughts, they had the power in their hands, if they so wished, to hurt him the most. Remember, however, they did not set out to run down Job. Their intentions were entirely noble and sincere, which is why that question is put up for you to ponder. Something had to happen to subvert their original plan and turn something that was meant for good into something that caused much evil and hurt to Job. What could have happened then to turn noble intentions into something that was wicked? As far as I can see, there is only one factor that could be responsible for this. That what had happened was that Satan got himself involved and he subverted the plan of the three friends to the extent that words which were meant to comfort became arrows to strike deeper in. Remember this, that Satan had been given an extremely wide latitude by God. The only prohibition was Job's life is out of your reach. Apart from that, anything goes. So Satan had the widest possible latitude to do what he wanted, which means that he could now manipulate the minds of these three friends in such a way as to cause their words intended to comfort Job to become barbs or arrows to hurt Job. And if you think about the example of Christ, you'll realize that Satan followed a very similar strategy. He first tempted Christ in the wilderness unsuccessfully, and we would think that he would have been defeated soundly, but he does not give up. Satan returned later, and this time he used exactly what is happening here. He used someone who was very close to Christ to cause very great hurt to Christ. You recall who that person was? Satan manipulated the close intimacy between this person and the Lord Jesus, and this person spoke certain words intended for the good of Christ, but in the hands of Satan they became manipulated and they turned out to be something that the Lord had to rebuke immediately. Recall who that person was? The person to whom Christ said, "Get thee behind me, Satan." Peter. Same strategy. Did Satan give up? He did not. He went away. And this time when he came back, he succeeded. How did he succeed? He succeeded when Judas threw his arms around Christ and kissed him. And that was the ultimate betrayal. So be aware of the strategies of Satan. And be aware of the fact that this adversary is not easily defeated. If he is defeated in one battle, he will return again. And it is for this reason that Peter describes him as a roaring lion going to and fro. We see there in that description the restlessness of Satan, his unceasing activity to bring down God's people. What is the issue that constituted this great debate between Job and his friends? It is summarized for you in these points on the whiteboard. Basically, Job is saying, "I am innocent of secret sins. I've searched myself. There is no unconfessed sin in me." To that, the friends reply, "Look at the character of God. God is just. God will only punish where there is sin that is not repented of. If there is no sin at all for God to punish, then something is out of character. It's not in keeping with the character of God. A just God will only punish where punishment is deserved. So you, Job, are suffering so terribly, it can only mean that you have sinned terribly, even though you are not aware of it." But Job says, "I searched myself through and through. There is no unconfessed, no hidden sin in me, nothing that I haven't repented of and confessed to the Lord." If Job is correct in that assertion, then in the light of the premise that the friends stated earlier, that a just God only punishes where there is unconfessed sin, if Job is correct in saying, "I am free of any unconfessed sin," then that logically there can be only one conclusion. God is inherently unjust. And that is an awful dilemma for anybody to be in. Logically, if Job is correct and his friends are correct as to the character of God, then logically it means that God is unjust. That position is not one that you and I would like to be in. So that is our preparatory material for the study of chapter 3. We will not go into much detail into the cycle of arguments, but we need to note one thing, that chapter 3 should not be considered in isolation. Chapter 3 goes with the remaining chapters up to chapter 31. So chapters 3 through 31 form an independent section. They are poetic in nature, and they consist of a cycle of speeches between Job and his friends. The speeches become increasingly tricky, increasingly elaborate, and increasingly difficult to follow. What is peculiar about the cycle of speeches is this, chapters 3 through 31. No sooner is one speech delivered than another follows, either a rebuttal by Job or a speech by another one of his friends. There is no rest or intermission in between. No opportunity for Job to pause and catch his breath. It is almost as if barrage after barrage of psychological rockets are being launched at him. Those of you who have studied the history of World War II will realize that in the battle for Stalingrad on the Eastern Front, the German army was poised for victory. But one of the factors that turned the tide against them was the invention by the Russians of multiple rocket launchers. So what the Russian army did is they lined up row upon row of these rocket launchers, and each battery could launch several rockets at one go. And they had thousands of these rocket launchers lined up. So as the German army advanced towards Stalingrad, the Russians let go. And if you have seen the archive footage of the Battle of Stalingrad, you will find the horrific nature of the rocket launchers, and no rest at all. Barrage after barrage of rockets unceasingly hitting the German army. In the end, the German army was decimated and they had to retreat. That's one of the factors. Of course, the Russian winter played a part also. So in the case of the cycle of speeches, I'm reminded of the Soviet tactic used in defending Stalingrad. Hit Job with barrage after barrage of psychological attacks. Give him no chance to recover before he can adequately rebut one attack or repulse one attack, he's hit by another. This is psychological warfare at its most brutal. And the only agent I can think of who is a master at this kind of psychological attack is our old adversary, the devil. This is one of the reasons why you and I sometimes fall into spiritual depression, because though we are not subject to the same intensity of attack, Satan knows that compared to Job, we are small fry, so to speak. You don't use an atom bomb to kill a sparrow. All you need is a catapult. Satan knows that we are like sparrows. He just needs a few sharp stones and a shot at us with his catapult, and most of us will be knocked over. But be aware that psychological warfare is used very successfully by Satan to bring down God's people, which is why St. Paul keeps reminding us to guard our minds, because it is the mind, the human mind, that is the real battlefield. That is where the problems begin, and that is where the problems can be resolved. So the human mind is a particular target of satanic attack. It was so in the early days, it was so down the ages, it is so even today. If you have read the life of Spurgeon, you will realize that he was repeatedly subject to bouts of spiritual depression. Even Martin Lloyd-Jones testified to the fact that he was subject to repeated bouts of spiritual depression. This didn't come out of nowhere, you know. It came out of the hand of Satan, came from the hand of Satan. So please be aware and guard your mind with the word of God, because that is the only defense that you can have against this kind of psychological warfare. Back to chapter 3, what we will find is a mixture, a very odd mixture of cursing and whining on the part of Job. And you will realize as you read chapter 3 that in this whining and cursing, Job ended up doing what he never wanted to do, and that is to sin with his lips. The person who breaks the 7-day silence is of course Job. He begins chapter 3 in this way. After this, opened Job his mouth and cursed his day. Now the word used for cursed is the correct Hebrew word. It is not barak as was used earlier in chapter 1 verse 11, but it is kalal, which means in the strictest sense a curse. So Job is now doing what he never wanted to do, and that is to resort to cursing. Word of caution here, he is by no means cursing God. He is cursing himself. He's indirectly cursing his mother by cursing his birth. But even though he is not directly cursing God, note this, he is implicating God in his curses. Not the same thing as cursing God to his face, because had he done so, it would have been over. And we would not be here to read, the book of Job would not be in the canon of scripture. So he did not descend to cursing God, but he came awfully close, because in cursing his birth and indirectly cursing his mother, he was actually implicating God. In other words, holding God responsible. Why was I born for all this? Because you caused my mother to conceive. You, Lord, caused my mother to conceive. So the implication is, who is ultimately responsible for Job's plight? It is God himself. So that is what I mean by implicating God. But he did not curse God to his face. Who or what did Job curse? Let's see the details of his words. Verses 3 through 7. Let the day perish. Remember, this is poetry, so it is expressed in very flowery language. Let the day perish wherein I was born, the night in which it was said, there is a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness, let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it, let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. Verse 6, as for that night, let darkness seize upon it, let it not be joined unto the days of the year. In other words, let it be blotted out of the calendar. Let it not come unto the number of months. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. Job was not the only one who descended to such a depth of depression that he cursed the day of his own birth. If you may care to look up Jeremiah chapter 20 in your own time, Jeremiah chapter 20 verses 14 through 18, you will find a similar cry from a distraught heart. Words very similar to what Job used. Cursed be the day wherein I was born. Cursed be the womb that bore me. What is happening to Job now? This cry from his heart signifies not just unbearable distress, but it signifies something more serious. In striking Job physically, Satan has succeeded in muddling his mind, so he is no longer able to think clearly. By the mercy of God, he is kept from the ultimate sin, which is cursing God, but his thinking is very muddled. Verse 8 is a difficult verse to understand, so let me attempt to explain it before we go on. How does verse 8 read? It reads as follows: Let them curse it that curse the day, that is daylight, who are ready to raise up their morning. At face value, it doesn't seem to make sense. Let them curse it that curse the daylight, who are ready to raise up their morning. A possible interpretation would be as follows: Let the lovers of darkness, such as thieves and murderers, curse my birthday. Let them also who are weary of life curse the day of my nativity. To me, that is a proper logical interpretation of verse 8. In verse 11, he continues to give vent to his frustration and distress by asking, Why was I born alive? Why died I not from the womb? Why was I not stillborn? The fact of the matter is, he was born a thoroughly healthy baby, nursed by a very loving mother. He now realizes within himself the futility of this question. Why was I ever born? Well, you were born and here you are, a successful, mature man. So it's pointless asking why I was born. So he switches tack, and now he compares the benefits of being dead. It's a very curious point of view. We look upon death as something terrible, something that we would like to postpone as long as possible. But Job, in his present frame of mind, is saying, compared to what I am going through, there are many benefits to being dead. What are those benefits? Firstly, when you are alive, how many periods of joy and happiness do you experience? If you can honestly say, I am 45 years old and my life has been filled with joy and happiness for 45 years, I would say that you deserve an Olympic-sized medal, because it is the common testimony of everyone that looking back from your mature years, looking back, those interludes where you had true happiness and joy are actually few and far between. What separates them are periods of trial and distress. But Job says, look, when you are dead, none of this is going to happen to you. You have one long, uninterrupted repose. So that is a great benefit. Secondly, while you are alive, you have to be aware of social distinctions. When you meet a cabinet minister, you don't just grab his hand and say hi. Nor would you tap him on the shoulder and say, Hi, Mr. Taman. There's a protocol to be observed. But Job says, this is ridiculous. When you are dead, king and commoner alike are leveled out. There is no protocol, no status, no dignity. We are all the same. That's a wonderful benefit. And here's another benefit to being dead. Can you be touched by grief, by failure, by loss, by betrayal, by insult, by calumny when you are dead? Sinner and saint alike enjoy undisturbed repose. And this was the one benefit that Job craved for more than anything else in his present condition. So he's at a point in time now where he says, there are so many benefits to being dead versus being alive. I would rather be dead. Logically, very sensible. However, that does not mean we go and throw ourselves off the highest building we can find. The reality of the situation breaks through, however. He realizes in verse 20, he's very much alive. As he gives testimony to it, he says, "Wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul." Here, light represents life. Remember again that Satan was expressly forbidden to take away Job's life, but everything else was open for Satan to manipulate. This sentiment that death is preferable to life is expanded upon in verse 23. He says, why is life given to a man whose way is hid and whom God has hedged in? The idea here is this: why does God keep alive a man whom he has weakened and then planted in the very center of a maze, knowing full well that in his weakened condition, that poor man is never going to be able to find the way out of the maze? Why does God do this to me? We should refrain from coming down hard on Job, because if we look at ourselves carefully, under far less duress, we have caved in and given way to similar sentiments. Verse 25, like verse 8, needs a little explanation, because Job says, "For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come to me." The exact meaning continues to be a subject of debate among commentators even today, but the most appropriate reading or rendition of that verse that I could find is this: Job's afflictions descended upon him in a torrential flow. Before he could recover his composure, he was hit by the next calamity. So it reached a point where Job is saying, where one calamity hits me, what is bothering me now is not so much the calamity itself. It has happened to me. I can't do anything about it. But I'm now wondering what next is going to come. And it is that anticipation of yet another calamity which is most unnerving. If you are faced with just one calamity at a time, most human beings can cope with that. But when one disaster after another, as it happened in the case of Job, comes in a torrential flow, you get to a point where you are not so much bothered by the present calamity as by the fact that something else, maybe worse, is on its way to you. And that is an extremely unnerving position to be in. He began to dread what was coming next to him. We see from this that he has by no means forsaken God, but he is sinking fast. He is sinking spiritually. To close our study of chapter 3, let us try to address the key question with which Job at this stage was grappling. Why does God keep man in misery when he could easily release man through death? Why does God keep us alive when we are suffering? He could easily release us to our eternal rest. If we attempt to read the mind of God, perhaps the reasons why we are kept alive and not given the easy way out, the reasons could be as follows. 5 reasons. Firstly, such afflictions are necessary for our own spiritual development. Secondly, they serve to test our readiness to submit to the absolute sovereignty of God. It is all too easy to say, "Oh yeah, I recognize God is sovereign." But the proof is in the eating. When you are tested, are you really willing to submit to the sovereignty of God and acknowledge that it comes from the hand of a of your loving Heavenly Father. So afflictions serve to test our readiness to submit wholeheartedly to the sovereignty of God. Third possible reason, the afflictions that beset us, that God allows to beset us in this life, prepare us for the day of death when it comes. For an unrepentant sinner, the grave is not a place of quiet repose as he might think, but rather for an unrepentant sinner, the grave is a doorway to a life of eternal punishment. Punishment which dwarfs any suffering that you and I may encounter in earthly life. Fourth reason why God allows misery and affliction to come and not release us. There may be secret sins in us which we have not acknowledged before God or repented of. And if that is the case, a just God has to punish those secret sins. And finally, collectively, these afflictions that God sometimes sends upon us one after the other serve to highlight to us that the sinner's escape route is not jumping off a tall building, is not finding rest in the coffin, but finding salvation and redemption through the blood of Christ. That is the escape route and not death. So it reminds us of what is stated in Acts chapter 4 verse 12. Neither is there salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. It is only in the blood atonement of the Lord Jesus that we will find our rest and repose, not the grave. We close thus with our study of chapter 3. God willing, we will proceed to chapter 4 next Sunday.